The Prophet. The prophet was drowning men on Great Wyke when they came to tell him that the king was dead. It was a bleak, cold morning, and the sea was as leaden as the sky. The first three men had offered their lives to the drowned god fearlessly, but the fourth was weak in faith and began to struggle as his lungs cried out for air. Standing waist deep in the surf, Aaron seized the naked boy by the shoulders and pushed his head back down as he tried to snatch a breath. "Have courage," he said. "We came from the sea, and to the sea we must return. Open your mouth and drink deep of God's blessing. Fill your lungs with water that you may die and be reborn. It does no good to fight." Either the boy could not hear him, with his head beneath the waves, or else his faith had utterly deserted him. He began to kick and thrash so wildly that Aaron had to call for help. Four of his drowned men waded out to seize the wretch and hold him under water. "Lord God, who drowned for us," the priest prayed in a voice as deep as the sea, "let Edmund, your servant, be reborn from the sea as you were. Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel." Finally it was done. No more air was bubbling from his mouth, and all the strength had gone out of his limbs. Face down in the shallow sea floated Edmund, pale and cold and peaceful. That was when the Damfare realized that three horsemen had joined his drowned men on the pebble shore. Aaron knew the Spar, a hatchet-faced old man with watery eyes whose quavery voice was law on this part of Great Wyke. His son Stefarian accompanied him with another youth whose dark red fur-lined cloak pinned at the shoulder with an ornate brooch that showed the black and gold warhorn of the Good Brothers. "One of Gorhold's sons," the priest decided at a glance. Three tall sons had been born to Good Brother's wife late in life, after a dozen daughters, and it was said that no man could tell one son from the others. Aaron Damfare did not deign to try. Whether this be Graydon or Gormund or Gran, the priest had no time for him. He growled a brusque command, and his drowned men seized the dead boy by his arms and legs to carry him above the tide line. The priest followed, naked, but for a sea-skin clout that covered his private parts. Goose-fleshed and dripping, he splashed back onto land, across cold wet sand and sea-scoured pebbles. One of his drowned men handed him a robe of heavy rough-spun dyed in mottled greens and blues and greys. The colours of the sea and the drowned god. Aaron donned the robe and pulled his hair free. Black and wet, that hair, no blade had touched it since the sea had raised him up. It draped his shoulders like a ragged, ropey cloak, and fell down past his waist. Aaron wove strands of seaweed through it, and through his tangled, uncut beard. His drowned men formed a circle around the dead boy, praying. Norjan worked his arms, while Ross knelt astride him, pumping on his chest, but all moved aside for Aaron. He pried apart the boy's cold lips with his fingers and gave Emmon the kiss of life, and again, until the sea came gushing from his mouth. The boy began to cough and spit, and his eyes blinked open, full of fear.
"Another one returned."
It was a sign of the drowned god's favor, men said. Every other priest lost a man from time to time, even Tal, the thrice drowned, who had once been thought so holy that he was picked to crown a king. But never Aaron Greyjoy. He was a Damfare who had seen the god's own watery halls and returned to tell of it. "Rise," he told the sputtering boy as he slapped him on his naked back. "You have drowned and been returned to us. What is dead can never die."
"But rise," the boy coughed violently,
bringing up more water.
"Rises again!"
Every word was bought with pain. But that was the way of the world. A man must fight to live.
"Rises again!"
Emmon staggered to his feet.
"Harder and stronger!"
"You belong to the god now," Aaron told him. The other drowned men gathered round, and each gave him a punch and a kiss to welcome him to the Brotherhood. One helped him don a rough-spun robe of mottled blue and green and grey. Another presented him with a driftwood cudgel. "You belong to the sea now, so the sea has armed you," Aaron said. "We pray that you shall wield your cudgel fiercely against all the enemies of our god." Only then did the priest turn to the three riders, watching from their saddles. "Have you come to be drowned, my lords?" The spar coughed. "I was drowned as a boy," he said, "and my son, upon his name day." Aaron snorted. That Stepharian spar had been given to the drowned god soon after birth, he had no doubt. He knew the manner of it, too. A quick dip into a tub of seawater that scarce wet the infant's head. Small wonder the Ironborn had been conquered. They who once held sway everywhere, the sound of waves was heard.
"That is no true drowning," he told the riders. "He that does not die in truth cannot hope to rise from death. Why have you come, if not to prove your faith?"
"Lord Gorlson came seeking you with news," the spar indicated the youth in the red cloak. The boy looked to be no more than 6 and 10.
"Aye, and which are you?" Aaron demanded.
"Gorman. Gorman, good brother, if it please my lord."
"It is the drowned god we must please. Have you been drowned, Gorman, good brother?"
"On my name day, Dampier, my father sent me to find you and bring you to him. He needs to see you."
"Here I stand. Let Lord Goril come and feast his eyes."
Aaron took a leather skin from Russ, freshly filled with water from the sea. The priest pulled out the cork and took a swallow.
"I am to bring you to the keep," insisted young Gorman from atop his horse.
"He is afraid to dismount, lest he get his boots wet." "I have the god's work to do." Aaron Greyjoy was a prophet. He did not suffer petty lords ordering him about like some thrall.
"Gorrel's had a bird," said the spar.
"A maester's bird from Pike," Gorman confirmed. "Dark wings, dark words. The ravens fly o'er salt and stone. If there are tidings that concern me, speak them now."
"Such tidings as we bear are for your ears alone, Damphir," the spar said. "These are not matters I would speak of here before these others."
"These others are my drowned men, God's servants just as I am. I have no secrets from them, nor from our God, beside whose holy sea I stand."
The horsemen exchanged a look.
"Tell him,"
said the spar, and the youth in the red cloak summoned up his courage.
"The king is dead,"
he said, as plain as that. 4 small words, yet the sea itself trembled when he uttered them. 4 kings there were in Westeros, yet Aaron did not need to ask which one was meant. Balin Greyjoy ruled the Iron Islands, and no other.
"The king is dead. How can that be?"
Aaron had seen his eldest brother not a moon's turn past when he had returned to the Iron Islands from harrying the stony shore. Balin's grey hair had gone half white, whilst the priest had been away, and the stoop in his shoulders was more pronounced than when the longship sailed. Yet all in all, the king had not seemed ill. Aaron Greyjoy had built his life upon 2 mighty pillars. Those 4 small words had knocked one down.
"Only the drowned god remains to me. May he make me as strong and tireless as the sea." "Tell me the manner of my brother's death,"
His Grace was crossing a bridge at Pike when he fell, and was dashed upon the rocks below. The Greyjoy's stronghold stood upon a broken headland, its keeps and towers built atop massive stone stacks that thrust up from the sea. Bridges knotted Pike together, arched bridges of carved stone and swaying spans of hempen rope and wooden planks. "Was the storm raging when he fell?" Aaron demanded of them.
"Aye," the youth said, "it was."
"The storm god cast him down," the priest announced. For 1,000 years, sea and sky had been at war. From the sea had come the ironborn, and the fish that sustained them, even in the depths of winter. But storms brought only woe and grief. "My brother Balon made us great again, which earned a storm god's wrath. He feasts now in the drowned god's watery halls, with mermaids to attend his every want. It shall be for us who remain behind in this dry and dismal vale to finish his great work." He pushed the cork back into his waterskin. "I shall speak with your lord father. How far from here to Hammerhorn?"
6 leagues. You may ride pillion with me."
"One can ride faster than two. Give me your horse, and the drowned god will bless you."
"Take my horse, Damphir," offered Stepharion Spar.
"No, his mount is stronger. Your horse, boy."
The youth hesitated half a heartbeat, then dismounted and held the reins for the Damphir. Aaron shoved a bare black foot into a stirrup and swung himself onto the saddle. He was not fond of horses. They were creatures from the Greenlands and helped to make men weak. But necessity required that he ride.
"Dark wings, dark words."
A storm was brewing. He could hear it in the waves, and storms brought naught but evil.
"Meet with me at Pebbleton beneath Lord Merlin's tower," he told his drowned men as he turned the horse's head.
The way was rough, up hills and woods and stony defiles, along a narrow track that oft seemed to disappear beneath the horse's hooves. Great Wyke was the largest of the Iron Islands, so vast that some of its lords had holdings that did not front upon the Holy Sea. Garold Goodbrother was one such. His keep was in the Hardstone Hills, as far from the drowned god's realm as any place in the Isles. Garold's folk toiled down in Garold's mines, in the stony dark beneath the earth. Some lived and died without setting eyes upon salt water. Small wonder that such folk are crabbed and queer. As Aaron rode, his thoughts turned to his brothers. 9 sons had been born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy, the lord of the Iron Islands. Harlan, Quentin, and Donal had been born of Lord Quentin's first wife, a woman of the Stone Trees. Balin, Euron, Victarion, Euregon, and Aaron were the sons of his second, a Sunderley of Saltcliff. For a third wife, Kellan took a girl from the Greenlands, who gave him a sickly idiot boy named Robin, the brother best forgotten. The priest had no memory of Quentin or Donal, who had died as infants. Harlan he recalled but dimly, sitting grey-faced and still in the windowless tower room and speaking in whispers that grew fainter every day as the grayscale turned his tongue and lips to stone.
"One day we shall feast on fish together in the drowned god's watery halls, the four of us and Yuri too."
9 sons had been born from the loins of Quellan Greyjoy, but only 4 had lived to manhood. That was the way of this cold world, where men fished the sea and dug in the ground and died, whilst women brought forth short-lived children from beds of blood and pain. Aaron had been the last and least of the 4 Krakens. Balin, the eldest and boldest, a fierce and fearless boy who lived only to restore the Ironborn to their ancient glory. At 10 he scaled the flint cliffs to the blind lord's haunted tower. At 13 he could run along ship's oars and dance the finger dance as well as any man in the Isles. At 15 he had sailed with Dagmar Clefjaw to the Stepstones and spent a summer reaving. He slew his first man there and took his first two salt wives. At 17 Balon captained his own ship. He was all that an elder brother ought to be, though he had never shown Aaron aught but scorn. I was weak and full of sin, and scorn was more than I deserved. Better to be scorned by Balin the Brave than beloved of Urin Crow's eye. And if age and grief had turned Balin bitter with the years, it also made him more determined than any man alive. He was born a lord's son and died a king, murdered by a jealous god, Aaron thought. And now the storm is coming, a storm such as these isles have never known. It was long after dark by the time the priest espied the spiky iron battlements of the Hammerhorn, clawing at the crescent moon. Garrow's Keep was hulking and blocky, its great stones quarried from the cliff that loomed behind it. Below its walls, the entrances of caves and ancient mines yawned like toothless black mouths. The Hammerhorn's iron gates had been closed and barred for the night. Aaron beat on them with a rock until the clanging woke a guard. The youth who admitted him was the image of Gorman, whose horse he'd taken. "Which one are you?" Aaron demanded.
"Gran, my father awaits you within."
The hall was dank and draughty, full of shadows. One of Garrow's daughters offered the priest a horn of ale. Another poked at a sullen fire that was giving off more smoke than heat. Garrow's good brother himself was talking quietly with a slim man in fine grey robes, who wore about his neck a chain of many metals that marked him for a maester of the citadel. "Where is Gormund?" Garrow asked when he saw Aaron.
"He returns afoot. Send your women away, my lord, and the maester as well."
He had no love of maesters. The ravens were creatures of the storm god, and he did not trust their healing, not since Yuri.
"No proper man would choose a life of thraldom, nor forge a chain of servitude to wear about his throat."
"Gisela, Gwyn, leave us," good brother said curtly.
"You as well, Gran. Maester Murrenmoor will stay."
"He will go," insisted Aaron. "This is my hall, Damphir. It's not for you to say who must go and who remains. The maester stays." "The man lives too far from the sea," Aaron told himself. "Then I shall go," he told Goodbrother.
Dry rushes rustled underneath the cracked soles of his bare black feet as he turned and stalked away. It seemed he had ridden a long way for naught. Aaron was almost at the door when the maester cleared his throat and said,
"Urin Crow's Eye sits the sea stone chair."
The Damphir turned. The hall had suddenly grown colder.
"The Crow's Eye is half a world away. Balin sent him off 2 years ago and swore that it would be his life if he returned."
"Tell me," he said hoarsely.
"He sailed into Lordsport the day after the king's death and claimed the castle and the crown as Balin's eldest brother," said Garrow, good brother. "Now he sends forth ravens, summoning the captains and the kings from every isle to pike, to bend their knees and do him homage as their king."
"No," Aemon Damphir did not weigh his words, "only a godly man may sit the sea stone chair. The Crow's Eye worships naught but his own pride."
"You were on pike not long ago and saw the king," said Goodbrother. "Did Balin say aught to you of the succession?"
"Aye," they had spoken in the sea tower as the wind howled outside. The windows and the waves crashed restlessly below. Balin had shaken his head in despair when he heard what Aaron had to tell him of his last remaining son.
"The wolves have made a weakling of him, as I feared," the king had said. "I pray God that they killed him, so so he cannot stand in Asher's way."
That was Balin's blindness. He saw himself in his wild, headstrong daughter and believed he should succeed him. He was wrong in that, and Aaron tried to tell him so.
"No woman will ever rule the Ironborn, not even a woman such as Asher," he insisted.
But Balin could be deaf to things he did not wish to hear. Before the priest could answer, "Gorold, good brother," the maester's mouth flapped open once again.
"By rights, the sea stone chair belongs to Theon, or Asher, if the prince is dead. That is the law."
"A green landlord," said Aaron with contempt. "What is that to us? We are Ironborn, the sons of the sea, chosen of the drowned god. No woman may rule over us, nor any godless men."
"And Victarion?" asked Gorold, good brother. "He has the Iron Fleet. Will Victarion make a claim, Dunfir?"
"Euron is the elder brother," began the maester.
Aaron silenced him with a look. In little fishing towns and great stone keeps alike, such a look from Damfair would have made maids feel faint and sent children shrieking to their mothers, and it was more than sufficient to quell the chain-necked thrall.
"Euron is elder," the priest said, "but Victarion is more godly."
"Will it come to war between them?" asked the maester.
"Ironborn must not spill the blood of Ironborn."
"A pious sentiment, Dumfir," said Goodbrother, "but not one that your brother shares. He had Swain Botley drowned for saying that the Seastone Chair by rights belonged to Theon."
"If he was drowned, no blood was shed," said Aaron.
The maester and the lord exchanged a look.
"I must send word to Pike, and soon," said Gorold, good brother.
"Damphir, I would have your counsel. What shall it be, homage or defiance?"
Aaron tugged his beard and thought.
"I have seen the storm, and its name is Euron Crow's Eye. For now, send only silence," he told the lord. "I must pray on this."
"Pray all you wish," the maester said. "It does not change the law."
"Theon is the rightful heir, and Asher next."
"Silence!"
Aaron roared. "Too long have the Ironborn listened to you chain-necked maesters prating of the green lands and their laws. It is time we listen to the sea again. It is time we listen to the voice of God."
His own voice rang in that smoky hall, so full of power that neither Gorold Goodbrother nor his maester dared a reply.
"The drowned god is with me," Aaron thought. "He has shown me the way."
Goodbrother offered him the comforts of the castle for the night, but the priest declined. He seldom slept beneath a castle roof, and never so far from the sea.
"Comforts I shall know in the drowned god's watery halls beneath the waves. We are born to suffer. That our suffering might make us strong. All that I require is a fresh horse to carry me to Pebbleton."
That good brother was pleased to provide. He sent his son Graydon as well to show the priest the shortest way through the hills down to the sea. Dawn was still an hour off when they set forth, but their mounts were hardy and sure-footed, and they made good time despite the darkness. Aaron closed his eyes and said a silent prayer, and after a while began to drowse in the saddle. The sound came softly, the scream of a rusted hinge.
"Yuri," he muttered, and woke fearful. "There is no hinge here, no door, no Yuri."
A flying axe took off half of Yuri's hand when he was 10 and 4, playing at the finger dance whilst his father and elder brothers were away at war. Lord Kellan's third wife had been a piper of Pink Maiden Castle, a girl with big soft breasts and brown doe's eyes. Instead of healing Yuri's hand the old way, with fire and seawater, she gave him to the Greenlands maester, who swore that he could sew back the missing fingers. He did that, and later he used potions and poultices and herbs, but the hand mortified, and Yuri took a fever. By the time the maester sawed his arm off, it was too late. Lord Kellan never returned from his last voyage. The drowned guard, in his goodness, granted him a death at sea. It was Lord Balin who came back, with his brothers, Euron and Victarion. When Balin heard what had befallen Uri, he removed three of the maester's fingers with a cook's cleaver, and sent his father's piper wife to sew them back on. Poultices and potions worked as well for the maester as they had for Uragan. He died raving, and Lord Quellan's third wife followed soon thereafter, as the midwife drew a stillborn daughter from her womb. Aeron had been glad. It had been his axe that seared off Uri's hand, whilst they danced the finger dance together, as friends and brothers will. It shamed him still to recall the years that followed Uri's death. At 6 and 10 he called himself a man, but in truth he had been a sack of wine with legs. He would sing, he would dance, but not the finger dance, never again. He would jape and jabber and make mock. He played the pipes, he juggled, he rode horses, and he could drink more than all the winches and the butlers and half the Harlaws too. The drowned god gives every man a gift, even him. No man could piss longer or further than Aeron Greyjoy, as he proved at every feast. Once he bet his new longship against a herd of goats that he could quench a hearth fire with no more than his cock. Aeron feasted on goat for a year and named the longship Golden Storm, though Balin threatened to hang him from her mast when he heard what sort of ram his brother proposed to mount upon her prow. In the end, the Golden Storm went down off Fair Isle during Balin's first rebellion, cut in half by a towering war galley called Fury, when Stannis Baratheon caught Victarion in his trap and smashed the Iron Fleet. Yet the guard was not done with Aeron, and carried him to shore. Some fishermen took him captive and marched him down to Lannisport in chains, and he spent the rest of the war in the bowels of Casterly Rock, proving that krakens can piss farther and longer than lions, boars, or chickens. "That man is dead." Aeron had drowned and been reborn from the sea, the guard's own prophet. No mortal man could frighten him, no more than the darkness could, nor memories, the bones of the soul. The sound of a door opening, the scream of a rusted iron hinge. "Euron has come again." It did not matter. He was a Damfire priest, beloved of the god. "Will it come to war?" asked Graydon Goodbrother, as the sun was lightening the hills. "A war of brother against brother. If the drowned god wills it, no godless man may sit the sea stone chair. The crow's eye will fight, that is certain. No woman could defeat him, not even Aisha. Women were made to fight their battles in the birthing bed, and Theon, if he lived, was just as hopeless, a boy of sulks and smiles. At Winterfell he proved his worth. Such that it was, but the crow's eye was no crippled boy. The decks of Euron's ship were painted red to better hide the blood that soaked them. Victarion, the king, must be Victarion, or the storm will slay us all. Greydon left him when the sun was up to take the news of Balin's death to his cousins in their towers at Down-Delving, Crowspike Keep, and Corpse Lake. Aeron continued on alone, up hills and down vales, along a stony track that drew wider and more travelled as he neared the sea. In every village he paused to preach, and in the yards of petty lords as well. "We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return," he told them. His voice was as deep as the ocean and thundered like the waves. "The storm god, in his wrath, plucked Balin from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves in the drowned god's watery halls." He raised his hands. "Balon is dead! The king is dead!
Yet a king will come again, for what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger. A king will rise.
Some of those who heard him threw down their hoes and picks to follow. So by the time he heard the crash of waves, a dozen men walked behind his horse, touched by God and desirous of drowning. Pebbleton was home to several thousand fisherfolk whose hovels huddled around the base of a small tower house with a turret at each corner. 20 of Aaron's drowned men there awaited him, camped along a grey sand beach in sealskin tents and shelters built of driftwood. Their hands were roughened by brine, scarred by nets and lines, calloused from oars and picks and axes. But now those hands gripped driftwood cudgels hard as iron, for the guards had armed them from his arsenal beneath the sea. They had built a shelter for the priest just above the tide line. Gladly he crawled into it after he had drowned his newest followers. "My God," he prayed, "speak to me in the rumble of the waves and tell me what to do. The captains and the kings await your word. Who shall be our king in Balan's place? Sing to me in the language of Leviathan, that I may know his name. Tell me, O Lord, beneath the waves, who has the strength to fight the storm on Pike?" Though his ride to Hammerhorn had left him weary, Aaron Damfair was restless in his driftwood shelter, roofed over with black weeds from the sea. The clouds rolled in to cloak the moon and stars, and the darkness lay as thick upon the sea as it did upon his soul. Balon favoured Asher, the child of his body, but a woman cannot rule the Ironborn. It must be Victarion. 9 sons had been born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy, and Victarion was the strongest of them, a bull of a man, fearless and dutiful. And therein lies our danger. A younger brother owes obedience to an elder, and Victarion was not a man to sail against tradition. He has no love for Euron, though, not since the woman died. Outside, beneath the snoring of his drowned men and the keening of the wind, he could hear the pounding of the waves, the hammer of his guard calling him to battle. Aaron crept from his little shelter into the chill of the night. Naked he stood, pale and gaunt and tall, and naked he walked into the black, salt sea. The water was icy cold, yet he did not flinch from his guard's caress. A wave smashed against his chest, staggering him. The next broke over his head. He could taste the salt on his lips and feel the guard around him, and his ears rang with the glory of his song. 9 sons were born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy, and I was the least of them, as weak and frightened as a girl. But no longer. That man is drowned, and the guard has made me strong. The cold salt sea surrounded him, embraced him, reached down through his weak man's flesh, and touched his bones. Bones, he thought. The bones of the soul. Balon's bones and Yuri's. The truth is, in our bones, for flesh decays, and bone endures. And on the hill of Naga, the bones of the grey king's hall. And gaunt and pale and shivering, Aaron Damfair struggled back to the shore, a wiser man than he had been when he stepped into the sea. For he had found the answer in his bones, and the way was plain before him. The night was so cold that his body seemed to steam as he stalked back towards his shelter. But there was a fire burning in his heart, and sleep came easily for once, unbroken by the scream of iron hinges. When he woke, the day was bright and windy. Aaron broke his fast on a broth of clams and seaweed cooked above a driftwood fire. No sooner had he finished than the Merlin descended from his tower house with half a dozen guards to seek him out.
"The king is dead," the Damphir told him.
I had burned, and now another."
The Merlin was a bald, round, fleshy man who styled himself Lord in the manner of the Greenlands, and dressed in furs and velvets.
"One raven summoned me to Pike, another to Ten Towers. Your krakens have too many arms. You pull a man to pieces. What say you, priest? Where should I send my longships?"
Aaron scowled.
"Ten Towers, did you say? What kraken called you there?"
Ten Towers was the seat of the Lord of Harlaw.
"The Princess Asher. She has set her sails for home. The reader sends out ravens, summoning all her friends to Harlaw. He says that Balon meant for her to sit the sea stone chair. The drowned god shall decide who sits the sea stone chair." The priest said, "Kneel, that I might bless you."
Lord Merlin sank to his knees, and Aaron uncorked his skin and poured a stream of seawater on his bald pate.
"Lord God, who drowned for us, let Meldred, your servant, be born again from the sea. Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel."
Water ran down Merlin's fat cheeks to soak his beard and Firfox mantle.
"What is dead may never die," Aaron finished, "but rises again harder and stronger."
But when Merlin rose, he told him,
"Stay and listen, that you may spread God's word."
3 feet from the water's edge, the waves broke around a rounded granite boulder. It was there that Aaron Damphir stood, so all his school might see him and hear the words he had to say.
"We were born from the sea, and to the sea we will return," he began, as he had 100 times before. "The storm god, in his wrath, plucked Balin from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves."
He raised his hands.
"The Iron King is dead. Yet a king will come again, for what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger."
"A king shall rise," the drowned men cried.
"He shall, he must, but who?"
The Damphir listened for a moment, but only the waves gave answer.
"Who shall be our king?"
The drowned men began to slam their driftwood cudgels one against the other.
"Damphir," they cried, "Damphir king, Aaron king, give us Damphir."
Aaron shook his head.
"If a father has 2 sons and gives to one an axe and to the other a net, which does he intend should be the warrior?"
"The axe is for the warrior," Rush shouted back. "The net for a fisher of the seas."
"Aye," said Aaron. "The god took me deep beneath the waves and drowned the worthless thing I was. When he cast me forth again, he gave me eyes to see, ears to hear, and a voice to spread his word, that I might be his prophet and teach his truth to those who have forgotten. I was not made to sit upon the sea stone chair, no more than Euron Crow's eye. For I have heard the god who says, no godless man may sit my sea stone chair."
The Merlin crossed his arms against his chest.
"Is it Asher, then, or Victarion? Tell us, priest."
"The drowned god will tell you, but not here."
Aaron pointed at the Merlin's fat white face.
"Look not to me, nor to the laws of men, but to the sea.
Raise your sails and unship your oars, my lord, and take yourself to old Wyke. You and all the captains and the kings, go not to Pike to bow before the godless, nor to Harlaw to consort with scheming women. Point your prow towards old Wyke, where stood the Grey King's Hall. In the name of the drowned god, I summon you. I summon all of you. Leave your halls and hovels, your castles and your keeps, and return to Naggers Hill to make a king's moot. The Merlin gaped at him. A king's moot? There has not been a true king's moot in too long a time, Aaron cried in anguish. Yet, in the dawn of days, the Arnborn chose their own kings, raising up the worthiest among them. It is time we returned to the old way, for only that shall make us great again. It was a king's moot that chose Eurus Ironfoot for High King, and placed a driftwood crown upon his brows. Silas Flatnose, Harrog Hoar, the old Kraken, the king's moot raised them all. And from this king's moot shall emerge a man to finish the work King Balin has begun, and win us back our freedoms. Go not to Pike, nor to the Tentars of Harlaw, but to old Wyke. I say again, seek the Hill of Naga and the bones of the Grey King's Hall. For in that holy place, when the moon has drowned and come again, we shall make ourselves a worthy king, a godly king. He raised his bony hands on high again. Listen, listen to the waves. Listen to the god. He is speaking to us, and he says we shall have no king but from the king's moot. A roar went up at that, and the drowned men beat their cudgels one against the other. A king's moot! They shouted, a king's moot! A king's moot! No king, but from the king's moot! And the clamour that they made was so thunderous that surely the crow's eye heard the shouts on Pike, and the vile storm god in his cloudy hall. And Aaron Damfair knew he had done well.